what I'm going to do today is I'll finish off talking about quantum optics with a few experiments. So I could talk about this kind of thing forever because there's so many really nice experiments, but I'll just restrict myself to outlining a few experiments in a rough way. That seemed to bring out some interesting properties. And then I'm going to move on to a new subject, which will involve going back to Einstein's remarks at the 1927 Solvay conference. Okay, so let's finish quantum optics. So this is from a paper by Zhu, Wang, and Mandel in 1991. This may be my favorite quantum optical experiment. So let's try and draw this. Okay, so it involves two parametric down conversion crystals in an interesting arrangement. Okay. So remember, these parametric down conversion crystals have the property that basically they take a photon out of the laser and convert it into two photons, which are correlated in their directions. So you can pick out pairs of photons whose directions are correlated. So if you have a photon here, you also have one here. And we have here two such processes, one happening here and one happening here. The probability of one of these conversions happening is very small. So during any given run.
We have two PMDCs, right?
Yes, two. Two, yeah. Yeah, I'll explain that in a moment. This is novel. So here we have two. They're both pumped by the same laser, which means that there's a they have a coherent sort of constant phase relationship. Basically, have a coherent state coming in here. And remember, coherent states, when you send them through a beam splitter, you get a product state coming out. Here you have the vacuum coming in, which is a special case of the coherent state. So each of these are pumped by a coherent state from the laser. Oh, I forgot to absorb to that. Okay, you have these two processes happening. The process of converting to a pair of photons happens with very low probability. So at any given time, you're only likely to have one pair of photons produced, either from this crystal or from this one. Okay. But it's done so in a coherent fashion. So basically, you have you don't really know in a quantum sense whether the pair of photons have been produced here or here. So now what happens here? This crystal is essentially transparent to photons. There's a very small probability of anything happening if you send a single photon through here. And so this photon coming from this crystal will simply pass through this crystal and appear come out here. So this is why this is the same mode. So now imagine we detect a photon over here. Then we don't know whether that photon came from a process happening in this crystal or whether it came from a process happening in this crystal. And when you don't know something in quantum theory, that means you have a superposition, as long as you don't know it in an appropriately coherent sense. So what that means is we don't know if, when we detect a photon here, we don't know if the other photon is in this path or this path. In fact, we have a linear superposition of those two things. And that means that if we vary these phase shifters, we'll see a variation in intensity, these detectors, so we'll see interference. Okay. So this, in a sense, is a novel way of taking two separate processes and making them indistinguishable by aligning these C modes, aligning the mode from here with this one, so that you get interference over here. Okay, and any questions on that? Well,
can you explain the phases that you would vary to get interference? What do you mean by that?
Well, that's going to be my question. So, just if you vary these phases, put these phases at different settings, then and just look, for example, at the intensity you absorb here at this detector. Let's call this E and ABC D and E. So this is the intensity or the probability of detection at this detector, then it'll vary in this fashion. So if you vary any of these phases, then you'll get variation like this. And if you vary all of them, then some particular function, this is a 50-50 being specified, by the way. Some particular function of these phases will be the right thing to plot along the bottom. Does anyone have an idea what the function is? So in a Max Ender interferometer, if I have used if I vary these phases, I'll see interference, I'll see a variation of the probability of detection here. And the function at the bottom is simply the difference of those two phases. Because, you know, if I increase these by equal amounts, then I don't change what happens here. It's the difference that it matters. Any guess as to what happens in this experiment? because we've got three phase shifters. So what's curious about this experiment is that rather than adding this phase shift to here, this is what you'd imagine if it was like this. You know, if I had another phase shifter over here, then I'd just add. Just add these two. But over here, this phase shift gets added to this one. So we have phi A plus phi B minus phi C minus phi B. So the probability of detection is some sinusoidal function of this. That's not obvious. You know, the best way is to actually do the calculation. Is it clear to people why you would expect to see interference? So a few comments. What happens if I remove this detector and I just don't look here? Do I still see interference over here? And guesses? So, I mean, the answer is yes. Because the mere fact that I've aligned these two modes means that it's impossible in principle now to discover whether this other photon is here or here. It doesn't matter if I place the detector in this path or not. And one thing I could do is I could place the detector in this path much, much later, you know, the following day. And it shouldn't matter what I do the day afterwards, you know, for each. So if it did, then you could signal faster than light. In fact, you could signal backwards in time. So really, whether or not I place the detector here shouldn't make any difference. And then the other thing they did in this experiment is that they placed, after doing this and seeing the interference, they placed a blocker, I think that was the technical term we decided, for it, a sort of something that will stop the beam into this path. And so now, the photon coming from here doesn't pass through this crystal. And so now you lose interference. Because now, in principle, even if you don't look, in principle, it's possible to find out where the photon coming to this beam splitter came from, whether it came from this crystal or this crystal. So it's interesting that whether you see interference between with this photon, what's arriving here, depends on what happens to another photon. Okay, that wasn't necessary.
Can you explain again why you have phi C dependence? Because it seems like if you're throwing away path C, then none of the other paths, like amplitudes, depend on phi C.
Like which?
So there's two experiments. In experiment where you, this dependence here is the experiment where I don't put a block here and this goes through.
Right.
Okay.
Right,
yeah, we have a block. Okay. So so you're asking why you have phi C dependence even if you don't detect here? Yeah. Or.
To trace the path from the laser to each of the detectors, and none of the paths into either of the detectors depends on phi C. So, yeah.
So, the way to really see it is to do a calculation. I don't have a good intuitive explanation as to even why you have the opposite sign to the one you might expect. Exactly. Yeah, that's the way to see it. Yeah. Does that explanation make sense?
Yeah, exactly. So the term that you're
this is Q. So the term in the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian will contain the terms that are interesting are this one from this crystal, and then there's another term from the other crystal, which is B dagger, C dagger, P. The term that's interesting is this one, so far as this is concerned, and exactly that you end up with a phase in front of there. So that's why it adds to this phase. That was a succinct way of putting it. Okay. So again, we have a parametric down conversion crystal. And we pump it with a laser. So I should say this, the experiment I'm going to talk about here was one done in Zeilinger's group. I wish I could tell you the year in the sort of mid 90s. And they call this experiment the Tyrol cross. The Tyrol rail cross. Because of its similarity with a particular traffic sign that's found in Tyrol. This was when Zeilinger was in Innsbruck before he moved to Vienna. So you do parametric down conversion. But then what you do is you reflect your laser beam back through the crystal. Okay. So that means that you get a second round of parametric down conversion happening in the reverse direction. And you're doing it so that these photons will have the same frequency. And then they also reflect the signal and idler modes back through the parametric down conversion crystal. And then you place detectors here. And in the experiment, they move the positions of these three mirrors to provide phase shifts. So we call these. I should probably think in terms of, actually, in terms of reflection at a mirror causing an inconsistency, the question that you asked, Emily. Probably here, this is a good time to have two different modes, because so on the way out, we call it A, and on the way back, we call it A tilde, that's A prime. On the way out, B. On the way back, B prime. So here we have B prime and A prime coming out here. And now they vary the these phase shifts just by moving the position of the mirror slightly for each of these three mirrors. Any idea what's going to happen here? Anyone? Okay. So, well, you have two. If you look over here, there's two ways you could get a pair of photons over here, either from the first pass on the way out or from the second pass on the way back. But those two things are indistinguishable once you're over here. So you expect to have interference. But it's interesting the interference you see here. Because what's actually happened, the thing that's being interfered is whether or not you detect a pair of photons. So in the case where you have destructive interference, where these two processes interfere destructively, then you see no photons coming out here. So you can actually kill the production of pairs of photons in this way. And on the other hand, in the case where you have constructive interference, where the phases add up constructively, then what you see here is rather than getting twice as many photons because you have two passes, you get four times as many photons, four times as many pairs of photons because of the same thing I told you about, I think, in the first lecture. Remember, if this is the probability of producing a pair of photons on the initial pass, so you take the square root because we're doing quantum theory. You want an amplitude. And then the same, if you have the same probability on the return pass, so you add together the amplitudes because we have constructive interference. And then we have to take the square. Then that gives us 4p. So the we get 4 rather than twice as many photons as we'd expect here. So it's a curious quantum property. Okay. Okay. Well, there's many more experiments I could talk about in the context of quantum optics, but let me stop there. So I want to move on to Einstein's 1927 remarks at the Solvay conference. Okay. So this was one of the great conferences of physics. Proceedings of that conference have been relatively recently translated by Guido Bacigalupi and Anthony Valentini. There's a book called Quantum Physics at the Crossroads, which you can either buy or you can download it off the archive. It's well worth reading. It's about 500 pages long, so it's not an insubstantial piece of work, and it contains a lot of commentary on these proceedings as well as an actual translation. So Einstein didn't actually speak at this conference, but he did say a few words in one of the discussion sessions. And this is what he said. So he considered an experiment like this, what we have here is a hemispherical dome, or hemispherical surface here. Here we have a diaphragm with a hole in the middle. We have some source of particles, and the particles impinge, so go through this hole, some of them go through this hole. So we can consider the case where a particle goes through this hole. And then this screen here is a scintillation screen. And so you send one particle through, and some point on this screen will flash. Like this point here. And you can say that you've detected the particle. Okay. So the quantum treatment of that says that after this diaphragm, you have some wave diffracting out like so. And then just before the wave reaches this diaphragm, the scintillation screen, just before the wave reaches the scintillation screen, it spread out completely. And then you can use this wave to calculate the probability that you'll get a flash at any particular point on the screen. The problem for Einstein was that there was a kind of competition between two different notions. One is the notion of locality, and the other is the notion of completeness. So if we imagine that this wave function tells us everything about reality that we need to know, so this wave function is the complete description of what's happening here, so far as the particle is concerned, then just when this one flashes, there's a question as to why you don't also have a flash over here. Okay. And certainly, if you believe in some sort of principle of locality, then just prior to this flash, the only way for the flash over here to not also have some chance of having a flash in other places is if there's some kind of superluminal message, if you like, that gets sent out from this flash point telling the wave not to also be detected over here. Okay, so there's a sort of completeness versus locality. Now, if you give up either of these two things, you don't have a problem. If you say, well, it's perfectly okay when this flash is here for there to be some sort of instantaneous signal that gets sent from here all around the screen telling the particle not to be detected somewhere else, then you can explain what happens. So that's giving up locality. Or if you give up completeness, you could say, well, what's really happening here is that in addition to the wave function, there's an actual trajectory that goes through here. Or maybe not even in addition to the wave function. What you have is some trajectory, and what the flash happens at the point where the trajectory arrives on the screen. So that's a local way of explaining what happens. But it suggests that the wave function isn't complete because this trajectory isn't a part of the wave function. We can simplify this argument and consider instead this experiment. And so now the particle goes comes out from a source, and it's divided as a beam splitter, and it either ends up at A or B. So years ago, when I used to talk about this, I used to do a little demonstration. It's been a long time. But for your benefit, let me do it again. I used to try and choose the object that was the most comedic. So I used to use a potato, because that seemed to be the funniest to get the biggest laugh. But they didn't have any potatoes on the counter downstairs, so it's going to be an orange. Okay, so here's how it goes. So there's nothing up my sleeves, obviously. So we've got the orange here. See if I can do this. It's been a long time. Okay, good. So now the orange is under one of these two cups, we suppose. I should make it clear, at no point am I going to let you know where the orange is. You will never find out where the orange is. Let's imagine we do the following experiment. So it's a thought experiment. I'm not actually going to do anything. I'm trying to think about things I might do. So let's imagine I look under this cup, okay. If I look under this cup, I'm either going to find the orange there or not, as the case may be. One of those two things will happen. If I do find the orange there, then I know that if I look under the cup over there, I won't find the orange. Conversely, if I don't find the orange here, then I know that if I were to look under the cup over there, then I will find the orange. Now, if I believe that what I do here doesn't influence what is true about the world over there, then it shouldn't make any difference whether I look under this cup or not. The mere fact that I know that if I were to look under this cup, I would gain information that would tell me about what was under that cup means that there must be some definite fact about the world that the orange is either under this cup or isn't. There is an element of reality. For this particular instance, this particular run of the experiment, the orange is either here or not there. And I have to admit, I'm not completely sure where it is myself, although I had some additional information because I did it. Of course, in this case, it would seem ridiculous to suggest otherwise. We all believe that there's an orange and it's under one of those two cups. And in particular, over here, there is a particular state of affairs as to whether the orange is here or not. But sometimes especially in quantum foundations, it's worth really going over a point. So let's go over this point here. What I'm going to do, just to give you a heads up, is I'm going to show you how you can get an argument for if you take quantum theory to be true, and you take the wave function to be complete, and you assume locality, then you get a contradiction. So those three things can't all be true. And the argument is basically the one I just gave you with the orange. The only thing that differs here is that here we really believe that the wave function, well, here it's plausible to say that the wave function is now in a superposition of being here and here at the same time until you make a measurement. And this argument from 1927 is really a precursor to the more famous Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument, the EPR argument that came in 1935. And really, you can make the same technical point in this simpler context. So let me do that. So I'm going to take some definitions. I'm going to write down some definitions. And these are taken from the 1935 paper. Let me do this over here. So definition one, a completeness. In a complete theory, every element of physical reality must have a counterpart in the physical theory. That's a quote from the 1935 paper. Now let me define what I'm going to call psi completeness. This is a term borrowed from a paper by Harrigan and Speckens, and I'll talk about that more broadly in the next lecture. So psi completeness says all elements of reality. I'm going to call elements of reality EPRs. It's not clear whether Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen chose the name element of physical reality with this coincidence in mind. So, psi completeness. All elements of physical reality follow from the state vector. So in particular, what I want to say here is So here's an element of physical reality. This is detector A has the value. This is where, you know, this is where if I do the measurement A, so I look in detector A, then I would alpha equals 1, or I wouldn't alpha equals 0, find the particle there. This pertains to the system A.
What is the element of reality? How can we view it? Does it exist independent of our ability to measure it?
So it's meant to be a statement about the world. So it exists. So these elements of physical reality, they may exist independently of our ability to measure it. It may be something we could measure had we chosen to, but we chose not to, like whether the orange is under that cup. The idea is that just that there is some underlying reality and you know, described in some way, and we can talk about aspects of that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this is we are now asking metaphysical questions. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we're assuming realism.
Okay.
So we're assuming there is some real fact about there are real facts about the world. Even more than that, we're assuming that for our systems there are real statements that we can make about systems. And I'm going to elaborate on this in the next lecture, maybe more precisely using this classification scheme of Harrigan and Speckens. But the real question we're asking now is whether the wave function is sort of a complete description of that underlying reality. Yeah, these sort of things were important to Einstein because he was a realist and he wanted to believe that he was describing the sort of underlying that the physics was a description of underlying reality, not merely a prescription for making predictions. So in particular, we'd say that this was an element of physical reality if it's a property of the wave function. So the wave function, when we calculate this projection, when we calculate the probability of finding a particular value of alpha, say alpha equals 0, then we get probability 1. Okay. And here, in the context of this experiment, you should think of P as being equal to some projector. Well, I guess it's just this, I suppose. Okay. Psi completeness, this is, the terminology is from this paper by Speckens and Harrigan. This particular corollary is my statement, but it's essentially what they meant in the EPR or paper and what Einstein meant over here. Okay, so if we're going to talk about elements of physical reality, then we need some condition for their existence. So EPR give us sufficient condition for the existence of an element of physical reality. So I'll read it out. If without in any way, this is a quotation from the original EPR paper. If without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity, the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this quantity. Okay. So, I'm going to write this like this. This means so if for some property, obviously we're going to apply this to that experiment over there. This is a more general statement. If for some property, A being equal to alpha, given, if we have the probability of some property, given some information that we might collect, if that is equal to 1, and if this measurement here does not disturb what's happening over here, then there exists an element of physical reality and furthermore, this is true even if we don't measure. Oh, yeah.
I'm a little bit confused about the consistency of this definition because it seems like we've defined everything in terms of probabilities of outcomes of measurements.
Yeah.
But now we're making now we're requiring that this measurement B doesn't disturb A.
Right.
So what do we actually mean by disturb?
Good. So the problem is, how do we know that measurement B doesn't disturb A? And at this stage, we don't. And there's kind of in the EPR paper, which, although I'm giving a version of the EPR argument in this sort of simpler context, they just took this as given. If your measurement is sufficiently distant, then it doesn't disturb. You know, if you're performing a measurement on B, then because it's space-like separated, it doesn't disturb A. But they didn't state this explicitly. They didn't give these careful statements for that property. So there was a sort of implicit assumption of locality. One reason for that might be that the paper was really written by Podolsky. And if you look in Einstein's writings, his correspondence in particular, he was more careful on this point. Although also very unrelenting on the property of locality. So I'm going to write down now the step, the thing we need, which is the locality property. So we also need one last definition. Let me say a system by system, really, I just mean the bit of the world. So a choice of measurement over here doesn't affect this bit of the world over here. Okay. So that's the thing we need. And then, so given all these definitions, then the statement is that quantum theory, in conjunction with psi completeness, and in conjunction with locality, gives a contradiction.
Precisely without going into conditional probabilities, because it seems like that's not what we want. Or like, when you say a system is undisturbed by choices made at a space-like separation from it, I think that like the probabilities, or like the joint probability, there exists joint probability distributions, like you can, the conditional, yeah, the two probability distributions are independent.
Maybe this is not really a statement about about the distribution, the probability distribution. It's not a statement about it's not an operational statement so much as it's a statement about reality. So maybe I could even make this, I could say the elements of physical reality for a system. Let's do that. For a system. undisturbed. How about that? Does that clarify?
I guess it's just appealing to our intuition. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think so, very much. Yeah. So let's see. There's some quote from Einstein. I didn't find it this morning, but it's something like, the real factual situation in one place is not changed by choices made in another place. Okay. He says it, of course, much more eloquently. It is certainly appealing to our intuition, the sort of intuition I tried to sketch out over here. Very much. Okay. Let me just quickly write down the argument. So for that experiment, we have if we see the particle on side A, then we won't see it inside B, and vice versa. So we have probabilities of the form that I wrote down over there. So this implies, if I use locality, that we have an element of physical reality but we just don't know what alpha is equal to. So in particular, if we had performed the measurement at side B and we saw B equals 0, then we'd have alpha equals 1. Let me write that in full. Or if we'd seen B equal to 1, then we'd have alpha equal to 0. So one of these two situations is true in a given run of the experiment, just like the orange is either under that cup or is not under that cup. One of these two situations is true. And then this is true even if we don't make either of these measurements. But we also have the case that the wave function associated with the situation in the case where we put neither detector there is simply this. If we do the calculation, we get this. So this means, according to, if we assume psi completeness, that neither this or are elements of physical reality. Because they're not properties of the wave function. So that's the contradiction. Okay, that took longer than I thought it would. The main difference between this and the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument is that instead of considering a single particle, they considered a pair of particles that were prepared in some particular entangled state. And then at one end, they considered two different measurements that could be made, leading to different possible conclusions about what you'd have at the other end. Maybe I'll sketch that briefly this afternoon. So it was a slightly different argument, but the content, certainly this theorem is the same. Are there any more questions?
In your definition of cyclic,
yeah.
Wouldn't it be more acute to say that you have, like, if and only if there exists a psi such that the product with its projector is equal to one?
Yeah, you could say that. I think. And would it be better?
When I was doing this, I the psi completeness is something I'll give you a better definition of this afternoon. Really, I wanted this second statement to be a sort of consequence of psi completeness, not a restatement of it. I think what you just said would actually be a restatement of it.
Any more questions?
Okay, so this afternoon I'll go through this classification scheme due to Harrigan and Speckens, which sort of puts psi completeness in the context of lots of other sorts of models, ontological models, so models of underlying reality that you could imagine. So we'll come to that this afternoon. Good.